Richard Branson, Sheryl Sandberg, Edgar Bronfman, Warren Buffett, and Bill Gates, people with incredible wealth, all of them. This is just a few of the 138 signatures of those who have signed the Giving Pledge, a promise to give the majority of their wealth to giving back. It's an admirable pledge, but is it the best one? Joel Fleischman is the author of Putting Wealth to Work, Philanthropy for Today or Investing for Tomorrow. He's not so sure. He joins us from Durham, North Carolina. Hello there.
Hello there, Bruce. Thanks very much for your interest, and I hope you're having a great day.
It is a great day here. You argue that this is the wrong choice for the majority of people and causes. Why?
Why? Because of the fact that any significant problems are going to be complex problems. They're not going to be easily solved in a short period of time, no matter how much money you put in. And so my view is that we have a track record of any number of foundations. There's some 90,000 foundations in the United States, and we have a track record of over 100 years of perpetual foundations that have made enormous contributions because they've done things carefully, deliberately, they planned, they've done due diligence, and they have the patience and also the capacity to correct the mistakes that they may make at the beginning. If you give away all your money in a short period of time, you don't have any left to correct the mistakes that you may have made in giving it away at the beginning.
If Bill and Melinda Gates were listening to a conversation, I think that they, as the founders of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, would argue that they do approach things with a great deal of care, and they've received a lot of attention for work on eradicating malaria, as just one example. When we look at that as a case study, what's your issue with that? I mean, they certainly apply science and thought and strategy, all the things that are important. What's the knock on them?
I have no issue with the Gates Foundation because, in fact, in the book, I actually asked a number of foundations, including the Gates Foundation, to describe what they were doing, how they were going about their business. The Gates Foundation is a spend-down foundation in the sense that it's supposed to go out of business 20 years after the death of the survivor of Bill and Melinda. So the question is, they are actually spending income. The difference between a spend-down foundation and a foundation that is a perpetual foundation is that typically the spend-down foundations are, in fact, trying to get rid of a lot of money in a short period of time. In fact, the Gates Foundation is not spending out of assets. It's spending out of only the income they're getting. They happen to get a lot of income, which is in terms of spending. They're spending about $4 billion a year. But if you look at what they've done, they're basically tackling problems deliberately in the same way that perpetual foundations do. But they've not actually spending down assets. They're spending income at this point.
So they're an exception.
They are an exception. That's exactly right. The Atlantic Philanthropies, which is another foundation which I worked at, is about to go out of business at the end of 2019, but it's committed all of its money. And so they have been spending capital assets, what they've done is basically the same kinds of things that they were doing when they were building up, before they were trying to spend down, basically. They're spending modest amounts of money in over a long period of time supporting organizations or supporting projects that enable them to accumulate the effects of what they're doing. They're not spending massive amount of money in the short run to try to solve a problem.
You have spent a very long time working in the area of philanthropy. What about that experience leads you to this conclusion?
Simply the record that the perpetual foundations have in fact achieved. And you look at it and say that 100 years of experience, enormous contributions to American society, and they're typically basically foundations that have been available to found new organizations that solve things like the environmental problems. The two leading environmental organizations, the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Environmental Defense Fund, they were all started by perpetual foundations spending income that nurtured their growth to the point where those two foundations now have, each of them, has 1.5 million to 2 million members, dues-paying members, and they wouldn't be there but for the money that they got to start up with the perpetual foundations. That's the kind of thing that spend-down foundations typically don't do.
What is there to be learned about the situation that has unfolded in Detroit? There have been a number of foundations really digging in there to solve some seemingly intractable challenges. What has worked and what hasn't worked so well about their approach?
Well, remember that all of the foundations that have pitched in for the so-called Great Challenge effort in Detroit, they're all perpetual foundations. Every one of them. They gave more than they usually give. The Ford Foundation gave the largest amount. The Kresge Foundation gave the second largest amount, $100 million, and then there were several 15 or so other foundations that did. The foundations that really stepped up to try to figure out how to save Detroit from bankruptcy and to save the collection of the Art Institute, that every single one of those foundations is a perpetual foundation. Mm.
So why are, and I don't know if they're new billionaires or if they're billionaires with old money here, but what would be appealing about a spend down that's more appealing than a perpetual foundation?
Well, what is appealing to most of the spend downs are new foundations. There are very few foundations. There are some, but not the, but very few foundations that are legacy foundations where the money was coming from earlier generations. The phenomenon, I think, as I say I try to explain in the book, strikes me as being this: people who make a lot of money when they're young, and they make it typically in starting companies of one sort or another, and they experience a great glow about the achievement in the for-profit sector of the things that they've supported and they've initiated, products of one sort or another or services. They are looking for a different kind of experience from the nonprofit sector, and so they are eager to make a difference in the short run.
Sounds like ego.
Impatient.
Is that an unfair term?
What?
Ego. It sounds like ego.
Well, the answer is, it is ego, but it's sort of misplaced ego in a sense. I don't actually criticize the people who are spending down. I simply say you have to ask yourself questions about how much money you've got, how complex is the issue that you're working on, how long is your time window for solving the problems, and do they align very well? Hmm. And so is it driven partially by ego? I think the answer is yes, yes, I think that's right. But you look at, Andrew Carnegie, who actually first articulated the goal of spending your money during your lifetime, ended up not being able to spend his money during his lifetime because he found that he couldn't find enough things that he could actually cope with that he was attracted to spending it on. So he had a quarter or a fifth of his whole net worth ended up going into a perpetual foundation. Hmm. Yet his book, the Gospel of Wealth, has the main message is spend your money during your lifetime.
Interesting. Now, he's the library guy. Isn't that one
the library guy.
Right. An extraordinary legacy and one that is referenced in many, many small communities across North America, not just the U.S. One of the huge changes coming soon that you write about is baby boomers and the wealth that they will inevitably donate to the philanthropic sector. That's you estimated something like $500 million over 20 years. What's the risk, in your view, about that wealth transfer?
That if it is spent, the risk ultimately is let's sort it out just a little bit. The intergenerational wealth transfer itself is in the trillions, but the estimate is that the people who make such estimates for a living say that approximately 15% of what goes in terms of an intergenerational wealth, that's wealth itself from one generation to the other, about 15% of that is going to end up in charitable contributions. That's what historically has been the case. And so, but the danger is, if a person decides, receives a legacy and ends up giving it away quickly without having taken the time to think about and craft a solution to a problem that is commensurate with the size of the problem and the amount of money that they've got and the time frame that they've got, if it's not commensurate with that, a lot of it's going to be wasted. That's the problem. You know, take a good example of a grant which everybody who studied it says was mistaken and ended up being wasted for the most part was Walter Annenberg's gift when he decided he was going to put in $500 million into improving public education in the United States. And he did it in a short period of time with inadequate oversight. And that's $500 million, which according to all the studies that have been made, was virtually all wasted.
Hmm. It seems analogous to shipping a plane load of teddy bears to earthquake victims or hurricane victims or something like that. They might make a child feel nice for a day, but that $10 could have gone to rebuilding a school or something like that.
Absolutely correct. And that's the tough call. People want to do good, but if they make their major goal spending money in a limited period of time and putting all their money out in that limited period of time, they really do run a very high risk of paying attention only to giving the money away and not with the impact that the money could achieve.
You write about the burden on children, which I hadn't thought about. Wealthy donors don't want to put this onus, this responsibility on their kids to spend the money in a way that brings their values to life. And I hadn't really thought about it. Tell us more about the challenge that this Gen 2 faces.
It is an extraordinary challenge because of the fact that typically families which have a lot of wealth, they tend to spoil their children. I don't want to overgeneralize. There's some of them don't spoil their children, obviously, many of them. But the fact of the matter is that the children, by and large, I didn't use names for the most part in this because I didn't feel comfortable doing it, and I think their parents and the children themselves wouldn't want it. But I know a number of families where the children really don't want to be involved in their parents' philanthropies. For parents who are smart, they try to involve the children in their philanthropy, and sometimes it works fine. What doesn't work fine at all is to involve, if your children don't get along with one another, the putting them into a situation where they're trying to figure out how to spend philanthropic dollars is no cure for family sociopaths. It doesn't work. And many foundations have tried it, and they end up breaking them apart into separate foundations because you can't force kids who don't want to work together to work together. But having said that, there are many examples of foundations where the parents have systematically involved their children in their work in their philanthropic duties. A good example is the Hewlett family, the Hewlett Packard Company. Mm. Walter Hewlett decided that he was going to have a way of training his children for the foundation. So he set up two foundations. One of them, the Hewlett Foundation, which is a multi-billion-dollar foundation, and the other one is something called the Flora Foundation, which is named for his wife, which is a much smaller organization, maybe $100 million. But everybody who goes to work on thinks they might end up being part of one of the trustees of the Big Hewlett Foundation has to prove themselves in the Flora Foundation and in philanthropic giving. It's a farm club for Hewlett, and you look at the record of that foundation in renewing itself with children. And particularly that's a foundation which requires us, I don't know, four or five members of the family to be on the board of the big foundation at any given time. So you want to train them right. But that's a wonderful systematic way of doing it. Or there's a foundation I write about in the book called the Saul Family Foundation. They own the John Saul together with his partner own SAS Software.
Right. Joel, so much to talk about here. I'm sorry to cut you off. We could talk all day, but it was really insightful to learn more about the complexity and nuance. I mean, I thought it was just as simple as cutting a check. I didn't really. But in some ways, we think that it is. I appreciate you providing your wisdom. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure being with you, and have a great day.
Thank you. Joel Fleishman, the author of Putting Wealth to Work, Philanthropy for Today or Investing for Tomorrow.